Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hello, I'm Saeeda Barsi.
And I'm David Badil, and welcome to A Muslim and a Jew Go There.
And this week, as I introduce this, I feel like that the national anthem should be playing in the background, because firstly, we're going to be talking about that great British institution, the BBC. We're going to be asking, has it been politicised? Is it impartial? And how has it dealt with the reporting of the war in Israel and Gaza? And secondly, we're going to be talking about that great British value, free speech, attempts to curtail it, blasphemy laws, and what that means for culture and comedy.
The BBC, what a big old thing it is, and it seems to be an enormous sight of people wanting to argue. It's almost like people in Britain want to argue more about the BBC's coverage of Israel-Gaza than the actual conflict itself. And I don't want to do a spoiler alert here, but in the same way that I am slightly a maverick in my Jewishness, in that I am as a non-Zionist and don't see Israel as my Jewish homeland, and that puts me outside the mainstream, it turns out the mainstream of British Jewish people all think the BBC is biased. They all, about 80% of Jews, think the BBC is biased in its coverage specifically of Israel. So as I say, no spoiler alerts, but I think it's pretty balanced. However, I'm going to try on this podcast to represent and talk about those issues, those specific issues, where Jews have seen examples of bias. And I think you're going to tell me, Saeeda, that people on the Muslim side of the fence also think it's biased, but in the opposite direction.
They do. And I think if I've lost count of the number of people who've called me over the last 6 months and have complained about something they've seen on the media, particularly what they've seen on the BBC, because I think they expect the BBC to be of a higher standard when it comes to issues of impartiality. So a poll conducted by the think tank More in Common in December found that roughly equal numbers of people find the BBC's coverage to be pro-Israel as they think it is pro-Palestine. But also what's interesting is that even more of the 2,000 people that were polled felt that the public broadcaster's output on the conflict between Israel and Hamas had been mostly neutral. So I think what I probably think is happening is that people who consider themselves to be pro-Israeli think it's biased and in favour of the Palestinians, and people who consider themselves to be pro-Palestinian consider it to be pro-Israeli and biased in favour of Israel. Yeah. And most people who probably don't have a dog in the game think that it's fairly neutral.
I think what that demonstrates is something which is, to some extent, the curse of our age, or maybe it's the curse of all ages, which is the power of confirmation bias. Essentially, people will see the world, and perhaps particularly reporting on the world, in terms of their own fixed ideas of how the world should be. And if it goes against that, they will assume that the reporting of the world is biased. But shall we dig into one or two things? I can begin with talking about what I know has upset Jews. Number one was on October the 7th, straight in, there was anger and upset because the BBC would not call Hamas terrorists. Terrorists. I'm going to call them terrorists. I struggled there for a second. Now, what should I call them? Because I'm not going to call them militants. But this caused a lot of fuss, is that they are a proscribed terrorist organisation, but the BBC would not describe them, and specifically the people who perpetrated those attacks, as terrorists. So that caused a lot of fuss. And I think John Simpson, the veteran BBC reporter, wrote a blog in which his basic point was impartiality, obviously, which is the lodestar for the BBC. It's this idea of impartiality, and that calling Hamas terrorists would be to come down on one side. And the pushback against that is that, of course, certain organisations that have committed atrocities have been called terrorists by the BBC. The BBC do refer, or have referred in the past, to Al-Qaeda as terrorists, to ISIS as terrorists, to Boko Haram as terrorists. They have done that. And I guess the feeling, therefore, is that by not referring to Hamas as terrorists, and I would say, you know, Hamas are different because they are also the legitimate government of Gaza. So there is a complicated thing there. But by not referring to them as terrorists, there was one member of the BBC who said Nelson Mandela was once a terrorist, and various members of the IRA, who the BBC would call terrorists, would now be considered respected politicians. And so the sense was, we need to give this the space in a way of time and history. But I think that is very complicated, and I would push back on it. as regards specifically the attacks of October the 7th.
I think it would have been much easier for them to call the October the 7th attacks terrorism without having to get into the big political debate about terrorist. Because as somebody once said, in the end, every terrorist will probably have a cup of tea at the Dorchester when these matters are dealt with politically. And what I thought the bigger issue was when people started talking about the Israel and Palestine conflict, and I think this has now been borne out by a report. So there's been a really interesting report done by the Center for Media Monitoring, which looks at the use of language, particularly at the BBC. And what it says that is that when it talks about rights, Israel's right to defend itself is talked about at a ratio of 4-1. 81% of the mentions are about Israel's rights and less than 19 are about Palestinian rights. So I think what a lot of Muslims were saying was that we understand that this is a terrible terrorist attack, which has, amongst other things, targeted civilians. But what we want you to do is talk about this in the wider context of the backdrop of the occupation. And when you talk about Israel's right to defend itself, you've also got to talk about Palestinian rights to resist occupation. And what's really fascinating is that when this study was done, Center for Media Monitoring study, they looked at 200,000 TV clips and online articles and looked through how the occupation and the mention of it was missing most often in those conversations. So what was felt, I think, amongst Muslim communities was that somehow the 7th of October was treated as the ground zero moment, when actually many people who've been involved in the Israel and Palestine issue for decades and decades said, no, this has been going on for decades. And the fact that you haven't talked about what has been happening in the West Bank and the killings that have happened there at the hands of the settlers, but also by the Israeli army, and the fact that we now treat this 7th of October as the ground zero moment. I don't think we can argue about the rights and wrongs of it, but I think this was the big difference, that for a lot of people who were pro-Israeli, they saw the 7th of October as the moment, and that's what we needed to talk about. And lots of people who were pro-Palestinian acknowledged that, but felt that it needed to have the context of the occupation and what had been happening for years beforehand.
Okay, so I think you're right that time does get decompressed, and definitely the wider context sometimes is left out. Jews, I think, now feel, some of them, that when people talk about what's happening in Gaza now, October the 7th is forgotten. Jonathan Glazer's speech, which we talked about last week, I know a lot of Jews are upset that felt like just talking about the occupation and the Israeli government as if they were wholly responsible for the violence, whereas it missed out any reference to October the 7th and Hamas. But I just want to come back specifically to some of the flashpoints that have been involved in the BBC and its reporting. There's a few, actually, but the other big one I would say would be the bombing of, I think it was Al Ahli Hospital. I don't know if I've got the pronunciation correct there, but the bombing of a hospital early on. That was reported by a BBC journalist as being an Israeli airstrike. There were 500 people, I think, described as killed. I don't know, actually, what the final analysis was. Typically in this situation, the truth is still somewhat elusive as to what exactly happened. But the general sense, I think, is that it was more likely to have been a misfired rocket from Islamic Jihad, one of the groups fighting in Gaza against the Israelis, and that less people were killed than were initially reported. But the fuss tended to be about the fact that the BBC straight away decided that was the case, that the narrative of who's the principal aggressor here meant that they expected that to be Israel. And I just want to say something about that, which actually is key, which is I actually think that I can accept absolutely that the journalist who said that was in the fog of war making a decision. He's got a report to file and he made that decision. But then you have to think of what happens as a result. And in the hours after that happening, a Berlin synagogue was firebombed. Angry mobs descended on a Spanish synagogue. The Alhama tomb and synagogue, one of Tunisia's most important Jewish sites, was smashed and burned. And for me, of course, the key thing about that is they're all Jewish places. They're not Israeli places. That the fact that a possible misreport of a war crime by the Israeli government led to reprisals against Jewish sites all over the world is a problem for me. That's why the BBC's reporting is so important.
What happened at the time was, because it's a Christian hospital, and very senior members of the Christian community said that this had been attacked by Israel. And I think that was used as a point of reference, because it was assumed that the senior Christian leaders within Palestine would know about what was happening to their hospitals. But I think what's interesting in all of this is that considering the furore that there was over the Al Ahli hospital, and actually it's still disputed and it still hasn't been settled as to exactly where that hospital was attacked from, the fact that since then every single hospital has been attacked by Israel in Gaza and most of their healthcare has been decimated means that the questions that I'm asking some of my colleagues who got very vexed at the time to say the BBC has reported this and has reported it to be an Israeli attack. And I think the argument somehow was as if Israel would ever attack an hospital. How dare you suggest this? The question now is that was definitely questionable in terms of what the accuracy of that report is, and it's still questionable. But the fact is there is now very clear evidence that every other hospital in Gaza has been attacked by Israel. And I don't hear the furore from the same people saying, and this is absolutely abhorrent.
You know, I agree with that. I don't know enough about the on-the-ground situation in Gaza. But of course, I assume what the Israelis would say and what some pro-Israeli Jews would say is that I don't know how much evidence there was of Hamas operating in that hospital, that therefore it was a, and I'm going to put this in inverted commas, innocent hospital, and that therefore the attack was would have been an unqualified war crime, whereas the other hospitals, I assume, there is a sense that Hamas have been operating underneath or within the hospital. That is their justification, and I'm totally prepared to accept that justification is complex, and it's, you know, that we have to listen to what the IDF are telling us, much as we have to listen to what Hamas are telling us, and it's very unclear sometimes exactly where the targets are. But I think that would be the reasoning.
For me, it's less complicated because there's this thing called the Geneva Convention, which basically puts healthcare facilities out, even in moments of war. But can I, David, talk about what I think
Hang on, I'm going to have to ask you about that. So I'm just going to ask you about that because I agree with you about the Geneva Convention. And I don't know. I throw myself upon the mercy of everyone who knows absolutely what's going on here. But I don't know. And I am reading reports, many of them disputed, saying that Hamas deliberately use hospitals in order to win the propaganda war, which, by the way, they've won, I think, generally. They've won the propaganda war. Israel has become in many places a pariah state. But they deliberately use those places in order to create that for Israel, to create the image of Israel destroying ill people, which, by the way, I know has happened. I'm not disputing that has happened. The question is, the responsibility may lie totally with Israel, and some people will think that. Other people will say Hamas are putting themselves in this position deliberately to create the situation, which is just a nuance, really, on your point about the Geneva Convention. I don't disagree with it.
The only thing I would say in response to that is if we had, even if we had a terrorist who committed offence and then ran inside a shopping centre and we knew loads of people in there, forget hospitals, let's just say it's a shopping centre and there were lots of people in that shopping centre, we certainly would not go in and nuke the whole shopping centre and kill all the civilians inside it because we were trying to find the terrorists who we thought were inside the shopping centre. That probably is the easiest way to explain the Geneva Convention.
I agree with that.
So I want to come back to the BBC. What concerns me is two things. One, the politicisation of the BBC, and I want to come back to that. But also what has been now documented as anti-Palestinian bias. And I think it's really important. We've talked about this a lot. There's a subjective perception, which we've both talked about, what Jewish communities, Muslim communities feel about the reporting by the BBC of Israel and Palestine. But then there's the objective. And Mona Chalabi, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, wrote about a report that had been done analysing the language in 600 articles and 4,000 live feed posts when discussing the issue of Israel and Palestine. And I want to talk about three things. First of all, language. What these reports found that was language when it was talking about the Israelis was 11 times more likely to be referred to in a way in which Israelis are referred to as victims of attacks rather than Palestinians. And so if I take three phrases that are used, murdered, massacred and slaughtered, that when these words were used, murdered is used 101 times for Israelis, but once for Palestinians. Massacred is used 23 times for Israelis, once for Palestinians. And slaughtered is used 20 times for Israelis and never for Palestinians in this particular analysis that they did over a period of months. And I think this is really important because how you describe people determines whether they're humanized or dehumanized. The second thing which I thought was really interesting was that when the BBC got it wrong and they apologised for getting it wrong, the language that they used about apologising to Palestinian errors was not, the word apology was not used. The words they used was poorly phrased and misleading description. Whereas when they got it wrong in terms of the Israeli position, they started it with, we're issuing an apology on behalf of the BBC, and then went on to say the words were incorrect and we misquoted a report. And I think what the point that I was making was that they used those words, but then at no point did they say, we apologize for the fact that we've done this. And again, I think language matters because it determines whether we believe somebody or don't believe somebody, whether we consider them to be authoritative or not authoritative. And I think the third thing, which I thought was really fascinating, was an error, the BBC will say an error, in relation to translation of a young person who was released from an Israeli prison. And upon being released, she was interviewed, a young girl, and she said in her interview, I was held in the cold without electricity, sprayed with pepper spray and left to die. That was the Arabic official translation when it was subsequently looked at. The way in which the BBC reported it as a translation was, no one helped us, only Hamas cared, we love them very much. The ridiculousness of how you could get such a translation so badly wrong with such a different...
I read the entire translation. She does praise Hamas at the end of it. There's not no praising of Hamas, but without any doubt, although there was a mistranslation, the implication that she didn't even mention Hamas is wrong. She did praise them. At the end of her full testimony, she does say, nobody felt our sufferings. Only Hamas felt our sufferings. We thank them a lot and love each other a lot. So that's just really a nuance on what you're saying.
Yeah. And I accept that. But I think the concern that I had was the fact that during the translation, they chose to use the bit about Hamas rather than the bit where she was talking about her treatment in an Israeli prison.
Yeah. I agree with you that this stuff all needs to be looked into. And I do agree with you that it can lead to a sense that one side is seen as somewhat more human than the other. But I'm not sure it's straightforward at all. Can we just widen this a little bit? Because there have been a few other incidents over the last few years in which the BBC has come under fire for attitudes towards both communities. I think that part of the issue is often to do with the BBC Arabic channel, where a lot of people get very animated about specific people who've worked there and who have posted specific things on social media. Some of those people have indeed lost their jobs because of that. I think it's that the BBC are desperate, in fact, in Jewish Muslim news to be balanced. And I think the BBC sometimes gets into a partiality through its desperate need for impartiality.
I think you're right. It is about the BBC wanting to do what they call both-sidism. And interestingly, I've been speaking to some people who work at the BBC who want to remain anonymous. And they say that when they raise these concerns, the issue that they have, and it probably brings us to the point about the BBC and the politicization of it. One of the things that was raised was, how do I, as a staff member who is Arab or Muslim, when I raise my concerns about the BBC and the coverage of things like Israel and Palestine or Muslims and Jews, how do I raise my concerns when the owner of the Jewish Chronicle, a pro-Israeli publication, when he sits on the board and he's an arbiter of impartiality? And I think that the issue here is about the political appointment of individuals into the BBC who then, when they go there, reflect a very specific government view of how they see the world. And if you look at how the government has seen the Israel and Gaza war, I think there is no doubt that the government has been one-sided on this. I think if you look at the way in which they're implementing culture wars and the latest announcements around extremism and what is seen as really a kind of war on British Muslims, what I think is quite deep-rooted anti-Muslim sentiment now in certain aspects of the government is then transposed onto the appointments that they make, and they follow that through in the BBC. So I'll give you two examples if I can. There was a situation at the beginning of the Israel-Gaza war where the editor of the Jewish Chronicle, Jake Wallace Simons, actually put out a terrible tweet. I questioned him on it at the time, and eventually he did, to his credit, delete it. But what he said was, much of Muslim culture is in the grip of a death cult that sacralizes bloodshed. And it was a terrible way in which he described all Muslims. And I pushed back on that. And yet 2 weeks later, the BBC had him on their flagship program, Question Time. The same with another, Melanie Phillips, who basically dismisses the concept of Islamophobia, and her articles disturbingly appeared in the Anders Breivik manifesto, the man who then went on to commit the terrorist attacks in Norway. She is regularly on Question Time. And yet, a couple of weeks ago, when the Secretary General of the Muslim Council of Britain was invited onto Question Time, the government decided that it would not put up a government representative to sit alongside her, and the BBC then withdrew her from being on Question Time. And the crime that she was held responsible for was that about 15 years ago, the Undershnook to the Undershnook to the Undershnook at the MCB went
to... I don't know what those words mean, are they Jewish? Undershnook, Undershnook, Undershnook.
Some lowly person in the MCB went to a conference overseas and in his private capacity said something that was considered to be potentially anti-Semitic. I don't even remember the details of it. It was that long ago. It was at the time when the current SecGen, Zahra Mohammed, I think, was still at college. And so she's being held responsible for something that was said by somebody in the organization that she's now leading 15 years ago. And on the basis of that, she's not on Question Time, but people like Jake Wallis-Simons and Melanie Phillips are on Question Time. And that concerns me.
Firstly, the whole Robbie Gibb thing is something which I'm just going to say out loud. I get incredibly bored. I get incredibly bored with anything that involves names of people who most people don't know, who people who are very obsessed with politics get, oh, this person is here and they're in a networking and they used to work for this person and blah, blah, blah. Clearly, Robbie Gibb should probably not be in a position of impartiality at the BBC. He's clearly someone who's on the side of the government. Fine. And clearly, and something, by the way, the Jewish Chronicle, which I know a little bit about, I don't know if he actually owns it. He's down as the owner, but I think the actual owners are all a bit murky. And I don't want to say murky because it implies some kind of Jewish conspiracy, but it is a bit murky. But
that's
my main
even more
interest
worrying
what we're
then,
talking
isn't
about,
it, David,
hang on, something I need to say, which is what we're supposed to be talking about is the BBC and whether the BBC are actually biased, right? And the fact is, the idea that the BBC is in any way controlled by Jews, which is something that far-right people say to me, and indeed, as I said on my Holocaust denial documentary, when a Holocaust denier told me that the BBC was controlled by Jews, that if the BBC was controlled by Jews, I'd be on it a lot more. So I'm sure Robbie Gibb should not be in that position. I also know that the Jewish Chronicle is pretty extreme. I do not believe that any of that proves that the BBC is biased. The fact that Melanie Phillips is on Question Time, yeah, she's pretty extreme. Nigel Farage is on Question Time. They put extreme people on there. I think in terms of that person from the Muslim Council of Britain being bumped from Question Time, that's bad, but I think probably that was purely a sort of, as it were, show business decision, because the government, who are, we agree, biased, decide not to put out a proper person because that person's there, then it's not a very good episode of Question Time. I don't think that shows the BBC is biased, personally. Another example being, there's a lot of fuss about Gary Lineker, who is a friend of mine and, you know, a hero of mine because he scored so many goals for England. But leaving that aside, there is quite a lot of fuss about the sense that he is very pro-Palestinian on social media. So people are calling for his sacking as a result of it not being impartial. And that's just not going to happen. And I don't think there's any sense it's going to happen. I don't think it should happen, by the way. But that's not the point. The point is, if this big Jewish powerful bias existed at the BBC, then he would have been fired.
So let me come back on this, David. For me, it's not about Jewish control, inverted commas. What I'm concerned about, for example, with Robbie Gibb, is that he sits on the board and owns the Jewish Chronicle. And if you look at what the Jewish Chronicle have been doing, since 2021, Ipsos has recorded 33 breaches of its code of practice, and it's admitted and paid for 4 libel settlements. So the person who owns this kind of a publication, and by the way, was also a former advisor to GB News, which has been chastised by Ofcom for its constant flouting of broadcasting rules. This is somebody who's involved with and has been involved with organisations that flout rules and break the code and have to settle libel settlements, and is now in charge at the BBC and looking at the issue of impartiality, and is a political appointee. All of that, for me, at the heart of the BBC rings alarm bells.
Yeah. Robbie Gibb's been appointed by the government. He doesn't control the BBC. He doesn't control... as far as I can make out, he's there talking about impartiality, and he may be right. He may be very, very pro-Israel and all the rest of it and not impartial. Therefore, it's a bad appointment by the government, who, as we know, are biased. I agree with you on that. The BBC, I see no evidence of that apparent bias. That's why I referred to, I think, power. But I didn't say Jewish bias. I didn't say Jewish power. I didn't mean that Jews were in control, because, by the way, none of these fuckers are actually Jewish. None of these people, Robbie Gibb, William Shawcross, all these names that you hear, none of them are actually Jewish. But let's say they represent Jewish interests. I could just tell you, and I think we come back to the fact that 50% of people think that it's biased one way and 50% of people think the other. That suggests to me it's not biased. I think you think it is from what we've been discussing, so that's fine. But I just think it isn't. Therefore, where is this power going? Where is this apparent huge power that you've described Robbie Gibb as having? Where's it going on the screen, on website?
Yeah, I don't think so. I gave you the examples of where I think there's been bias in the reporting through use of language and the way in which the arguments are framed. But I don't think the BBC itself is biased. But I think the BBC over time is becoming more and more politicised. We saw that with the appointment of Richard Sharp as chairman, who was a Tory donor, and he had to stand down. With Tim Davey, who stood as a Conservative councillor a number of times. With Robbie Gibb, who was a advisor to a Conservative prime minister. I've been speaking to a number of people at the BBC, and this one actually really struck me because I took it down as I was speaking to this person. And they said that this political influence, it casts a shadow that hangs over us and stunts our journalism. First of all, if there is clearly concerns where BBC staff cannot do their job independently as journalists because they feel like the shadow is hanging over them, then that is not a healthy place for us to have an independent national broadcaster. And secondly, if this climate is being created, I think it's right for people like Robbie Gibb and others who are creating this perception, if it is just a perception, to step away. Because the BBC hasn't just got to be impartial, it's got to be seen to be impartial. Yeah. Both of those things are important.
Yeah, I agree with that. I can only just say Robbie Gibb cannot sack anyone at the BBC. I mean, I've sat with Tim Davey, who I know well, who is actually the Director General of the BBC, so actually got the power to sack anyone. He is struggling, as we all are perhaps, but certainly he is, to try and remain as unbiased as possible, even though, yes, he once stood many years ago as a Conservative councillor, which you as a Conservative person, I think, might approve of, because lots of people think that the BBC has mainly got a leftist bias. So it's not that terrible that there's someone there who once stood for the Conservative Party. He's certainly not in any way, you know, far right, and certainly not in any way massively pro-Israel. I know this from speaking to him. So that's the point, is the people on the ground independently doing their jobs, I don't think, are biased. There's a sense in which the institution, people want to say, is biased, partly because of this notion that we have of structural and institutional contamination. But these are just people doing their jobs. And I agree with you about Robbie Gibb. He should not be in that position. But I don't think the BBC is biased.
I agree with you. The BBC is an amazing institution. I see the amazing work that it's done over the years, especially in BBC World Service, how it's an essential element of our soft power. But I do worry about the politicisation of it. I suppose what I want to do is really conclude on this, because we should have what I think is a shared interest in objective news, because it then forms the baseline of facts. And in a time where, you know, politics is so post-facts and post-evidence, we can't begin to appreciate both sides of the trauma in an issue such as Israel and Palestine and the impact of that conflict on future decisions and political decisions that may be made in Israel about a two-state solution, if we confine ourselves to weaponizing the media to win an argument or champion one side, which is why it's important that we don't start to use the BBC as a theater of war, as sometimes the House of Commons has become.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Okay, so moving on, one of the things that's happening at the moment, obviously with the extremism bill going through Parliament and all the rest of it, is there's talk again about essentially the notion of Islamophobia and some arguments about the word. I believe Kemi Badenoch tweeted fairly recently that she much preferred the word anti-Muslim hatred, which we might do too, but she carries a slight sting in the tail with the notion that Islamophobia, too much focus on that word and that concept might be a way of, and I think this is more or less a quote from her, getting in a blasphemy law by the back door. So that, I want you to tell me what you think about this rather than me, the non-Muslim, speaking about it. But I would just say, as far as I understand it, the notion is that if you use Islamophobia rather than anti-Muslim hatred, then criticism of a religion, criticism of certain religious practices, which should be allowed under free speech, will suddenly overlap into racism. And that is the issue.
So this is one of the accusations that has been thrown back by various members of the government quite disingenuously, because it's been explained to each of them in detail in person, including to Kemi Badenoch, but they still try and put this nonsense out. So this word Islamophobia has been used for decades. It's been used by anti-racist campaigners. It's been used by the United Nations. It's not actually a word that I like, David. And so when the Cross-Government Working Group on Islamophobia and Anti-Muslim Racism did its inquiry, over a period of years, they took evidence from around the country, had open meetings, had written evidence sent in, had sessions in Parliament where evidence was given. The overwhelming sense was that although Islamophobia wasn't a perfect word, far from it, it was the one that most Muslims use to describe their racism. And I think, as you and I have discussed in the past, it is in the end up to communities to define their racism. And that includes the word that they want to use to talk about that form of racism. But you do raise a really important question here, which is, where is the distinction between anti-Muslim racism and blasphemy laws? And this definition is not there to protect the faith, because that is blasphemy laws. It is there to protect believers or perceived believers. And one of the strongest pieces of evidence was that the number of attacks that Sikhs had and Sikh Gurdwaras had been attacked because they were perceived to be Muslims. As a Muslim, I do not want any form of blasphemy law in this country. We stopped doing blasphemy decades ago. I think the last successful prosecution was in the 1977, 70s,
I believe,
for this.
Yeah, the actual facts are that blasphemy laws were repealed in 2008 in the UK. They only ever covered the Anglican faith. In 2006, the Labour government passed its Racial and Religious Hatred Act, making it an offence to incite hatred against a person on the grounds of their religion. In 2012, a successful campaign was made to amend the Public Order Act, led by Rowan Atkinson, who obviously is a comedian, so that would have been relevant to why he was doing it, to ensure people could express their opinions and beliefs and insult people without fear of prosecution.
And interestingly, during the Rushdie controversy, one of the issues for Muslim communities was that the blasphemy laws were still on the statute books. So what they were saying was, we want you to extend these to protect everybody. And more recently, I have campaigned across the world to get rid of blasphemy laws. Why the hell would I try and bring them or be part of a group that would try and bring them back in the United Kingdom? In fact, much of my work when I was a minister at the Foreign Office involved going to places like Pakistan and others, saying to them that these blasphemy laws are a relic of the past. They were introduced during colonial rule. They do not represent the way in which the world lives today, and you need to find a way to get rid of them. But those that are disingenuous around anti-Muslim racism will tie you up in, it's meant to be blasphemy, rather than engage on the very real issue of the fact that Muslims in this country are being attacked and the statistics prove that.
I agree, of course, that there needs to be a word and indeed an initiative to combat anti-Muslim racism, and Islamophobia seems to be the one. The reason that fear exists, that there might be an attempt to get a blasphemy law going or for blasphemy to be a major issue, is that blasphemy has, of course, become an issue in Salman Rushdie, in the Charlie Hebdo incident, Theo van Gogh being killed for making a film submission, which is about how women are treated in some aspects of conservative Islam. And more locally, in things like there is in a school in Kettlethorpe, I believe, where an autistic boy had to go into hiding because of a belief that he scuffed a Quran. There is a teacher in a school, I don't remember where the school is, but also in the north of England, who is still in hiding because he showed the cartoons of Muhammad because he was trying to provoke a discussion about blasphemy. So the question, I guess, is that if those are seen as Islamophobic behaviours, and certainly the reaction to them has been very strong, what does that mean in terms of being able to have a moderate discussion about what Islamophobia is when those things are happening?
These are really important questions, David. I'm really pleased that you're asking them, because often these are dealt with in the media in a way which is not really with any understanding of what was happening on the ground. Both the teacher case in Batley and the Kettlethorpe case of the young boy, I am familiar with. And it was actually Muslims on both sides who wanted to engage and try and find a way in which we could resolve what in both cases, actually, by the way, was an issue in relation to respect and teaching within school. Under the Equality Act, schools have a duty as a public body to deal with matters in school in a way which is understanding of difference on race and religion. So interestingly, the one with the young boy, immediately it was actually local people who became involved and Muslim communities who wanted to calm the whole thing down, because again, I think there were extremes on all sides who were trying to ratchet this up. And then what they were saying was, no, this is a young boy, he's part of our local community. The boy's mother actually wanted to reach out and say, I want to be involved with the community, this has been some misunderstanding, because this kid decided to kick this, I think he bought a Quran in and then kicked it around in the school.
He's an autistic kid. He had brought in a Quran, but I don't think he actually did throw it around. I think it just got dropped and scuffed. I guess what I want to say is you're in that community and you're nearby, and so you'll know more about it than me. But I guess I think you're someone who, and I respect this completely, is always aware of the way in which these things get blown out of proportion and come to, as it were, smear all Muslims as being these extremists, these angry people, and that's how the media likes to portray them, and sometimes the government in their culture wars likes to portray them, and I completely accept that. But as far as I understand it, the boy is still in hiding. The teacher is still in hiding. Undeniably, I'm absolutely sure you're right that many Muslims are trying to resolve the issue and the local people are trying to resolve the issue. But there must be people within these communities, within these arenas, who are very extreme and very angry about it. Otherwise, these people would not be in hiding. And I guess the question to come back to the blasphemy law is, would those people be described as reacting to what they consider to be Islamophobia, the angry people?
Yeah. I don't know if the boy is in hiding, David. I don't know about the teacher. And so I really think we need to get to the bottom of this before we make these judgments.
But I'm going to push back on one thing here, which is I think it's really important. This is more of a general point, which is that a lot of the time you say to me, David, how do you feel about this as a Jew? And I have to really think about it and I have to consider it. And you push me brilliantly often about how far I'm prepared to examine my own support for Jews and the Jewish community and how Jews are seen, particularly at a time when it's really complicated. I sometimes think, when I try to get you to deal with the fact that these things do happen. There's obviously, I mentioned Rushdie, Theo van Gogh, all the other ones that are happening all over the world, that you are so concerned, and correctly concerned, that Muslims get stereotyped, that there is no room for the fact that there are bad actors. There are people who really want to weaponize blasphemy.
I completely agree with you, David. There are bad actors out there who define themselves as Muslim, who think that the way to express their anger and is through using violence and threatening violence. And it's why I have spent my whole life consistently making the case for why that is not a part of the faith, and that is not how the faith should be interpreted. I reached out to the school in Batley where this teacher showed the cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad, and I asked them to reach out directly to the teacher because I wanted to make sure that this matter was resolved. They did not take up that offer. It really concerns me. And I basically said,
motivation?
Look, if it means,
sorry, what,
I even
what
went as far as saying,
not doing that.
Either incompetence or whatever it was, it simply was not taken up. I remember making the offer in a way of trying to convince them as to how serious this matter was and how seriously I wanted to deal with it. I said, if the school has concerns about the safety of this teacher, I am prepared for him to come and stay at mine. And I am prepared to see this through and have the conversations that need to be had to make sure that this person is safe. If those offers are not taken up, what I don't want is this kind of demonization of the community that happens when there are, for every one bad faith actor, David, you have got hundreds of thousands of good faith actors who are saying to you, we need to create an environment in Britain where everybody feels safe and secure.
Yeah, I agree. Can I just interrupt?
We have to feel safe and secure. and we have to create the environment for others to feel safe and secure. And that's what I thought I was doing.
I agree. It sounds like you did brilliantly, to be honest. I think the problem is, in a way, is that, without wishing to sound like a stupid politician, obviously the vast majority of Muslims are not represented by these people.
You couldn't possibly sound as stupid as some of the politicians
The fear and self-consciousness that can be created just by the fact that it takes one person or two people, whatever, to create anger around these things does lead to, you know, problems. I mean, it's a problem sort of in my own industry. To talk personally for a minute, two things. One is, in the conversation we had about Sacha Baron Cohen last week, the reason that I got a bit edgy about it is I thought I don't want him to be in any way under threat for that. Similarly, when I wrote The Infidel, which is my film that I wrote about a Muslim who discovers that he's born Jewish, occasionally I make jokes about Jesus. Occasionally I make jokes about Christians and Jesus. And what I get sometimes is cross people on the internet saying, oh, let's see you do a joke about Muhammad now. And of course, I'm not going to do that. But my point is, should I be frightened for Sacha Baron Cohen? Should I get into the situation with The Infidel where, when my response to that is, there are jokes about Muslims in that film, many more about Jews. What there are not, and absolutely I was conscious when I wrote it that there would not be, are any jokes about the Quran, any jokes about Muhammad. I avoid completely anything that might be considered to be sacrilegious. That would not be the case with Christianity. Okay. Now, hold on, what I think is, it is no diminishment.
You asked me a question, you've got to let me answer
it. Okay, well, I'll let you answer it.
Should you be allowed to make jokes? Okay, you should not be in fear of the material that you are using if it is simply comic material. Because you know what people say to me, David, and I'll throw this back at you. People say to me, you speak so boldly and bluntly about Pakistan. You speak so boldly and bluntly about Saudi Arabia. Let's hear you speak so boldly and bluntly about Israel. And let's see where that gets you. Because are you going to be allowed to speak about it? And I'm telling you now, in politics,
continually, haven't you?
I haven't actually. No, plausible. Plausible as in the ICJ.
That's still pretty bold.
But I have to refer to legal evidence and backing. Until the human rights organizations came out and gave a ton load of evidence that the crime of apartheid was being committed, I did not use the word apartheid. Until Israel found itself before the ICJ with clear evidence presented to it of plausible genocide, I did not use the word genocide. And what's really fascinating...
You're a very just and correct person, but that's still pretty bold.
But it's accurate. And
you're
it's
just incorrect.
You can say what you like about Israel, really. Yeah, but you try speaking to most politicians within parliament, and that my colleagues will tell you that actually to be outspoken on the issue of Israel is career ending. To be outspoken on the issue of Islamophobia is a career ending issue, right? And that is, and by the way, there is evidence of this.
Definitely
in
not
parliament.
For
but
a
I
comedian.
Want to come back to
We're
this broader issue.
We're talking about comedy and the arts. Yeah. Well, it's definitely not for a comedian. The Onion, for example, probably the most widely read comic website in the world, is unbelievably anti-Israel at the moment and often very funny about it, really funny about it. The Onion's still totally successful. I'm sure within the corridors of power, there may be self-consciousness and people feeling a bit paralyzed about speaking out about Israel, perhaps. It's just not the case in the world of the arts. What I would like to hear from you, let's take Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who had to go into hiding because she wrote Theo van Gogh's film, Submission. Now, it had things in it that were offensive to Muslims, without any doubt. But you ask me often how I feel. What do you feel about the fact this is a woman who is in fear? A lot of the time she has carried on speaking, but she's still in fear about what might happen to her.
I haven't read it and I haven't seen it, but I always go back to this basic premise as somebody who's been on a number of kill lists over my lifetime and has been attacked. Nobody should live in fear of the way in which they live their lives. I know what that feels like. So nobody should live in fear of that. But I also say this, that if you're going to deal with issues that to some people are sacrosanct, let's talk about this. Holocaust denial is illegal in vast parts of the world, in Canada, in Germany, in Belgium, in Italy, in Switzerland. Nazi symbols are considered illegal in places like France and Germany. They're sacrosanct. We can not go there.
I would say, just in terms of Holocaust denial, just one thing is that this gets raised quite a lot. And I noticed that I think in Iran, after the cartoon thing happened, they had a Holocaust denial exhibition, which I believe Ahmadinejad at the time said, this shows that you find certain things sacrosanct, and we find certain things sacrosanct. Here's the difference. The Holocaust, and I apologise for any religious people listening to this, but I'm just going to say this. The Holocaust is an actual historical thing that happened, right? Religious tales, however much you deeply believe in them and deeply feel they're part of your identity, they are not factual things that happened. So therefore, contradicting them or subverting them or even making fun of them is just a way of saying you believe in something that might not be true. And it may, of course, involve Islamophobia. Of course it might. But it may also, say, in Richard Dawkins' case, be a way of saying, I don't think this is a belief system that I want to have respect for. Right? That might be what it's about. And certainly I think that's what Charlie Hebdo might have been about. Saying the Holocaust did not happen, which is clearly just a way of contradicting history, has no other purpose except to be anti-Semitic. It has no other purpose except to say the Jews have created this lie for their own purposes in order to control the world, get sympathy and earn money and weaponize it in Israel and all the rest of it. That's the only reason it's there for. And so I just think that's a false equivalent. Yes, it's important to people, the Holocaust. And yes, it may be held in some kind of slightly sacred status, but that's not what Holocaust denial is about.
In civilized societies, David, we exist in a space. Somebody said, just because I have the right to sit on public transport and fart doesn't mean I do it, because in civilized societies, it's offensive. And we live in communities, and the way in which we behave can have detrimental impacts on other people. In civilized societies, we consistently curtail our free speech. We curtail it around the Public Order Act. We curtail it on things like glorification of terrorism. We curtail it on things like Holocaust denial. We curtail it on anti-BDS legislation, which is anti-boycott, divestment and sanction legislation, which basically means that government should not boycott, divest or sanction certain states. What I believe is that if we are going to live in multi-faith, multi-racial, multi-religious societies, we don't need blasphemy laws. But what we do need is a respect in the public space to say that actually we need to conduct ourselves in a way where we understand and are sensitive to and are considerate towards other communities. But what we find when Muslim communities say, look, freedom of expression is a value and it's my fundamental right and I want to express my views in this way, we actually try and shut that down. And if you look at the pro-Palestinian marches recently, we've tried to shut down legitimate protest and legitimate freedom of expression. And that has been led by the heart of government, by the Home Secretary. So either we have freedom of expression in this country and we say to all communities that we actually allow you to have that space to develop that. And then when there are competing rights, we find a way in which we manage them so that nobody feels that they are curtailed and nobody feels that they are under harm or violence is going to come to them.
I agree with you that we live in a time where it's important to try and understand how every community feels. Just speaking personally, I think that I come from a sort of liberal, secular, primarily, background where artistic freedom of speech should involve the ability to offend. It should involve, you say, just because you can fart on a bus doesn't mean that you should. There's many examples of art that's designed to offend. People tried to shut down punk rock at the time because it was considered offensive. And my problem, I guess, is that I agree with everything you say about balance and trying to make sure that we live in a harmonious society. I think that all these examples of the shutting down of freedom of speech are complex and problematic, and I accept what you say about BDS and about all sorts of things. But I think violence as a response to freedom of speech, killing people, blinding people, isn't equivalent to these other examples, including government examples of the shutting down of freedom of speech.
I think violence that is used to shut down debate and discussion is completely unacceptable. These are debates and discussions that are happening within Muslim communities and have happened over hundreds of years, by the way, David. Even if you go back to the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, what I say to Muslims is, you have great teachings of compassion and kindness and forgiveness, which were shown and lived out by the Prophet you profess to follow. So why do you feel you have to act in ways that he didn't act in, that somehow somehow you have to be more concerned and more upset and more angry and more violent than he ever was. And so I think there is a cultural issue in all of this. There are parts of the world where anger, frustration, violence is seen as a way of responding to things. It's why in this country, you can go out, you can get a beef burger. In India, people get killed for eating a beef burger. That's how crazy it is, because those particular Hindus feel that actually that the cow is so sacrosanct that nobody should ever be allowed to eat beef. Do we think that's crazy? Yes, we do think it's crazy. Do people go out and kill in the name of Buddhism? Yes, they do. We've seen it in Myanmar and we've seen it in Sri Lanka. Do people kill in the name of Judaism? Yes, we've seen the extremist settlers. Do people kill in the name of Islam? Yes, they do. And they are appalling. And it's why all of us have to call this out and say violence in the name of a faith is not acceptable wherever and whoever uses it.
I agree. So before we go, a correction that we need to add from last week's podcast. I think I said that Jews are allowed to drink water on Yom Kippur. That's incorrect. So any Jews who have been stocking up on mineral water for next Yom Kippur, chuck it away.
Yeah, and any Jews listening in, just rest assured that I will make sure David is a good Jew by the end of this podcast.
Thank you.
So we've really gone there today, haven't we, David? There were moments when I felt that these conversations are getting more and more frank and exhausting. Yeah, but it's good. It's good therapy for us. And, hopefully people listening in feel like they're part of an interesting conversation too.
Yeah, I hope they feel wrung out.
So next week.
That's how I feel, wrung out.
As wrung out as we do. Yeah. I do. I feel really exhausted because these are really tough conversations. And they are tough conversations because what you're trying to do is to say, think about how I feel.
Yes.
But then you're also having to reflect and say, I hear you, I see how you feel. And that's it's emotionally draining, but they're important conversations that need to be had.
Yes, and I love you more and more every week, is what I find. I do. I do. I feel more and more endeared to you every week, even though we're having difficult conversations. Oh. So that's something. We have had loads of questions. Loads of people have sent through loads of stuff. So we'll do an episode very soon where we answer some questions. If you want to send us more questions, the email address is podcast@instinctproductions.com. Do you want a Yiddish word? Do you want a Yiddish word?
Yeah, go on. Tell me a Yiddish word. What is a Yiddish word for exhaustion?
There is a Yiddish word. Vermischt.
The word for exhaustion is probably takavad.
Oh, that's quite difficult. Takavad. Is that right? Takavad.
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 I'm not very good at that. Takavad.
Yeah, but T at the end.
I'm too takavad to say takavad. See you next week, everyone.
See you next week.
Muslim and a Jew Go There was brought to you by Instinct Productions.